You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Savvy, and tonight on Right On Radio, David Fettig talks with S.J. Sindhu, the author of Dominant Genes, a new hybrid chapbook of nonfiction and poetry from Black Lawrence Press. She is also the author of two literary novels and a graphic novel. Her first novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lies, won the Publishing Triangle Edmund White Award and was a Stonewall Honor Book and a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. Sindhu teaches at the University of Toronto Scarborough.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, I speak with Ronald E. Peterson about his memoir, An Introvert Learns to Fly, a memoir of timidity, panic, science, leadership, and love. From his early beginnings, living in rural Minnesota, he eventually went to graduate Caltech with a PhD in physics and eventually became an executive at Honeywell. Along the way, he meets Nobel Prize winners, testy bosses, altruists, and people hang on the edge of society. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, this is Dave Fettig, and there is Sindhu. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
How should I call you? S.J. Sindhu? What do you prefer?
Sindhu's fine. S.J. Sindhu's fine for, official purposes.
Okay, and we did that in our intro. Welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you're joining us from Toronto?
I am.
A kindred winter spirit you are. That's wonderful.
Yes, it is very cold outside right now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we have the same weather. Sindhu, let's talk about, before we talk about Dominant Genes and some of your other work, I want to talk about some of your other work too. We have a very bright group of people who listen to our radio show. You have to realize that. But still, let's talk about Tamil and where you're from. And tell us why that it's important for you to acknowledge your, or call yourself a Tamil diaspora writer. So please situate that place in the world for us. I looked it up. I looked deep into it. But and tell us why that matters to you.
Sure. So Tamil is a... it's a hard to define category, right? It's sort of a linguistic group, and it's sort of an ethnic group. It's sort of a cultural group, and so it's all of these things. It's linguistic, it's ethnic, it's cultural. Tracing our heritage to either the south of India or the north of Sri Lanka originally, and now most Tamil people, either live in the homeland, if you will, in the Tamil cradle, or live in diasporas. And there's many hundreds of thousands of Tamil people that live in diaspora communities in all over the world, mostly in Malaysia, Singapore, the UK, Toronto, and Sydney, Australia.
Oh, fascinating.
And it's important to me because for a long time, regardless of where we've been, we've always been a minority group within the states that we've lived under for the last 300 years. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we've always faced a lot of struggle and a lot of difficulty being acknowledged as a different group, as a cultural culturally sovereign group, and have had to overcome a lot of oppression over the years. And so because of all of that, it's important to me to draw solidarity with fellow Tamils across the world.
Well, thank you for that. And the diaspora, it's not a recent phenomenon then? It's been going on for some time?
Oh, yes. So the Sri Lankan Tamils have been leaving Sri Lanka for a long time, since the civil war started in 1983. And Tamils have been leaving India for much longer than that.
Okay. Thank you for that, Sindhu. And we're going to be learning and at least hearing about your culture and your background from your work. It's just so beautifully described in this chapbook, Dominant Genes. So let's begin at the top here with a reading, if we could, Sindhu, please. And Hopefully we'll have a chance to hear from you more than once, because there are some really interesting pieces in here. There are poems, there are stories, there are things I'm not quite sure what they are, if they're a memoir or, but that's what's fun about this, really rich and long, short book. I will call it that. So what are you going to read for us first?
I'm going to read from the very beginning, a very short piece called Birth Story and a poem called Gods in the Surf.
Okay, great.
Birth story. My mother, out of love, stitches up my heart, pulling the thread tight to make sure it won't rupture again at the same spot. My heart is defenseless, ready to come undone at the next crisis. While she's at it, my mother stitches up my mouth too and turns her needle and thread to my brain.
Thank you. That's Sindhu, S.J. Sindhu reading from Dominant Genes. And you have just introduced a theme I wanted to discuss at some point, so we're going to take it right now, which is this idea of stitching, sewing, bringing things together, two sides, two people, two types of people, two parts of Sindhu, I take it from reading this. So I don't want to give too much. Well, okay, hey, it's a main theme of the work, right?
It is.
And your mother's plays a big role in these works also, which leads me to another question. And we often have this conversation with poets who write about family and friends. Is it hard for you to do that? Is it hard for them to see them in your work? And how do you navigate those choices that you have to make if you want to be real?
It is difficult, I think, for my family, especially for my mother. She knows that I've been writing about her for a long time. She used to Google my name when I was in college, and she'd like see the things that I've been writing.
Love
and
it.
We'd have conversations. At this point, though, she's just sort of accepted it. And I think she chooses not to read a lot of the stuff that I write, especially right. the nonfiction and the poetry, because she knows that it would upset her. But, you know, I'm also coming from this very matrilineal heritage where Tamil people have a very long history of matriarchy. And, that's kind of what I'm exploring in this chapbook, is what I have inherited from the women of my family,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's, you know, physical traits or personality traits or cultural traits or memories
mm-hmm.
Or trauma. And so I can't get away from writing about my mother, even if it, you know, might not be the thing that she would choose I write about.
Right. You mentioned, I can't remember exactly the word you used, but who you are and appearances. And appearances really matter in a lot of these stories. And I want to just read a couple of brief sentences, if I may, from, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, Draupadi Walks Alone at Night. Close?
Mm-hmm. Draupadi.
Okay, Draupadi. At the end of the first paragraph, point, I look younger than I am. Point, I'm neither skinny nor fat. Point, I come from a dominant caste. Now, it wasn't always clear to me, Sindhu, if I'm reading about Sindhu or a character you've created to write a story, if these are memoirs or fiction, it's not always clear, and that's fine. But what I just read really stresses the fact that appearances matter, and they've mattered for you. Do you want to talk about that? This story, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about this story, too. It's fascinating.
Thank you. So I think appearances matter a lot, especially for immigrant populations and immigrant families, because they're trying to not really assimilate into this culture, but give the appearance that they're assimilating. So, you know, they want to keep the culture that they have brought with them, but at the same time, they don't want to be discriminated against. And the way to not be discriminated against often is to seem like they have assimilated into whatever Western culture that they have, made themselves a part of. And so appearances, whether that's, you know, the clothes you wear or the way you hold yourself or the way you speak, all of these things start to matter a lot, not just to the family themselves and not just to the community, but to the outside world. You know, how you present yourself as a visibly marked minority affects how you're treated, how you're received. And, you know, I'm a creative writing professor, and every time I walk into a classroom, how I dress and how I present and how I speak and how I hold myself will affect the way that my students respond to me. And so I can't, you know, I don't think that any of us, especially people who are marginalized, can ever get away from this idea that we are constantly being judged on appearance. And so because of that, appearance matters a lot.
Yeah. And it matters for the I in this story, if that's you, and it matters for the I in these poems, if that's you, within the family also, not just in society, because, and you suggested this earlier, the women in your life especially are worried about you and what's going to happen to you, who you're going to be with. There are many moments of, I would say, humor in this too. But there's not a question there, but it's an observation that how you look matters in many levels, according to it, yeah. Can you tell us a little more about this story, Droppity Walks Alone at Night? Where did it come from? I was really intrigued by it.
So this particular piece was... originally solicited for an anthology called Good Girls Marry Doctors. It was an anthology of South Asian women writing about the expectations that we've been put under and how we speak back to that. And so I specifically am entranced with this mythology of Draupadi, who is one of the main female characters of the Mahabharata, because she's so unusual for a female character, in that she is, you know, she's married to these five men. She is the subject of both awe and, you know, disrespect. So she's like this very polarizing figure that has, in different times in South Asian history, held different positions culturally. So, you know, at some points she's sort of vilified as a whore, and at some points she is sort of venerated as a sort of sacrificial lamb, if you will. So it's fascinating to me, but also like this duality. And that's something that, as you mentioned, I do play with in the chapbook, this idea of duality, this idea of split identities. And I sort of liked the parallel of her dual identities with my dual identities of, you know, being raised in the US mostly, but also being Tamil and having this background as an immigrant, being bisexual. So being able to sort of walk between gay and lesbian communities and also straight communities, and this kind of chameleon aspect of dual personality, dual identity. And so that's kind of what drew me to her story. And I think ultimately she's kind of a tragic figure, which I find really fascinating. Because I don't think she should be. I think she, you know, she doesn't have a tragic ending. She is, except for this one, instance that happens, she's a very strong figure. She's a very strong female character in the Mahabharata. And the fact that she's interpreted as a tragic figure, I think, says a lot about our culture and what we value, and that we value chastity in women, which I think is really bizarre.
It's such a powerful story, for as brief as it is, and thank you for that description. Do you want to read something from this? I didn't ask you to prepare anything from this story, but while you're looking, I love this. You get what you wish or ask for, but Lord Krishna explains to Draupadi, I'm pronouncing all these, that in her past life, she asked for a husband with five qualities, and since no perfect man exists, she got five husbands. Now I'm a guy, and I laughed at that. Poor thing. But anyway, would you like care to read from a part of this? That's sort of, if you can, I'm asking a lot of you right at the on the moment to that, yeah, that captures what you've been talking about.
Yeah, I can read a little piece of it.
Good.
Draupadi spends the first year of her marriage with the oldest brother, the second year with the second oldest, and so on. This so that everyone will know which son belongs to which father. She is the linchpin of the story, a victim of masculine sexuality like Sita of the Ramayana. The narrative revolves around her, but unlike Sita, no parents today name their daughters Draupadi. Sita the virgin and Draupadi the whore. The questions are simple, but no one asks them. No one wants answers. No one even wants the questions. The questions are landfills that loom like mountains. I tell my mother I'm bisexual. Bi from the Latin dwi, the Greek di, the Sanskrit dvi, meaning double, having two, living in two. I have bifurcated my life, brown and white, my family, parents, and me, my body, masculine and feminine. Bi meaning two, Draupadi, the wife and the whore. Bi meaning coexistence, meaning contradiction, meaning war.
Thank you. That's Sindhu reading from her collection, Dominant Genes, a checkbook out of from Black Barnes Press. Let's talk about fathers too, because I'm a father and I have a daughter. And there's a lovely moment, and see, I'm a sucker for scenes like this where a father is the least bit kind to his daughter and loving, but he cooks for you. And again, I don't know if this is you or if this is a story, but women are in here a lot, but dad shows up to cook for you when, I'm going to say you, for when the you character is in trouble. And it's mm-hmm. sweet. Where does your father come into this? Where do men come into in your life and in your culture?
I think I have a very unusual relationship with men and masculinity than, you know, what my culture prescribes, because regardless of the fact that, you know, Tamil culture was once matrilineal and matriarchal, centuries of colonial rule has really changed that and has made it a very patriarchal culture. But my father has always been sort of the nurturing one in the family. Mm-hmm. My mother's nurturing too, but she's, mm-hmm. you know, I think she's not naturally drawn to children. She's not like, you know, she's not warm in that way. And I'm the same way as she is, but my father loves kids. He loves cooking. He loves like feeding people. And it's just so much a part of him. And he grew up in taking care of all of his younger siblings. He has five younger siblings and he grew up taking care of them. And so he's always been a very sort of, almost motherly figure in my life. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you know, I write a lot about my mom, but I don't write a lot about my dad at all. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I don't think I have any issues. Like there's nothing to be worked out through the writing. So whenever he does appear, it's to be a supporting figure, I guess, in my life. Right. And he's always supporting, you know, he's not somebody to talk a lot about his feelings or about anyone's feelings. He's not that kind of person. He's very, professorial. He's very cerebral. He's always in his head thinking about some project or another, but he's always been there. He notices and he, shows his care in these ways, like cooking, mm-hmm. and making sure that, that I'm taken care of in the ways of like, you know, being fed and being nurtured and being warm and being clothed and being sheltered, like in those ways. And I've always really appreciated that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Before we run out of time, I want to let our listeners know that they can Google S.J. Sindhu, S-I-N-D-U, for your lovely website and find some work of yours on the website to read. You have some stories up there, which is nice of you to do as a writer. And I want to make sure that people can find out how to get dominant genes. Chapbooks aren't... they used to be the kind of things in cool independent bookstores when they come back, you'd find in a certain section. But how can people find dominant genes?
You can find all of the links to buy it on my website, sjsindhu.com.
Great.
No H. Sindhu is like the Indian way to spell it is with an H. Okay. I don't have an H in my name. Okay. So just putting that out there.
Perfect. The pandemic shows up in this book, which tells us that it's been going on far too long when writers can write something and have it published and get out, and we're still in the damn thing. So how has the pandemic shaped your work? How has it affected you as a writer sitting in that lovely room of yours? Maybe you're teaching from that room. How has it shaped you as a writer?
I mean, I've been basically living an online life since March of 2020. Yeah. I've been teaching online. I've been doing everything online. It's been harder to write in the pandemic, honestly. It's sort of without the input and stimulus of having a social life and being out in the world and being able to observe people, it's really hard to produce. I have been, you know, sort of slogging along, but I'm so excited to see the end, a light at the end of the tunnel, and be able to observe people again, and to be able to write, scribble things down on my in my notebook, and be able to use it later when I'm out in public.
How about as a teacher?
Teaching online, I abhor it. It is quite awful.
Yeah.
It does offer a lot of accessibility of the material for people who might not fit naturally into, you know, our regular education system.
Right.
But I think it tires students out to always be on a screen.
Sure.
There are students I've had for now 2 years that I've only known through a screen that we are about to go back in person, and I'm very excited to actually meet them in person.
Wow. Great. We're speaking with S.J. Sindhu, author of Dominant Genes, other chapbooks of, I believe these are chapbooks of poems and novels, very successful novels, which are now on my list, by the way. Sindhu, how about another reading before I get the high sign from Josh over here? What are you going to read for us?
I will read this poem called Gods in the Surf. I envy my American city friends, their impractical swimsuits made to be seen, not touched by sea, unable to stand in weak Florida surf. I was born by the ocean, an island child, the core of me salt water and seagulls howling. We wade into the gulf, the ocean holds us, amniotic fluid shot with jumping mullets, jellyfish constellations too small to see, worming their stinging tendrils into skin, waves spitting shark eggs and tangles of seaweed. Pelicans strafe the water. We gorge on chips, chug shitty beer under a rainbow umbrella. My city friends tell stories, innocent childhood beach trips, Florida vacations, coconut sunscreen. Back home, people saw gods in the surf, watery limbs and hair made of dirty foam. Fishermen went out to sea, came back, nets full of prawns, to bombed out homes. Children tried to hide in the sand, evading military planes only to shatter on landmines. I never saw visions in the waves, but I knew a boat with no motor and no lights could take me across a lagoon at night, and if I heard a helicopter, I should sink my body into the ocean and trust it to hold me.
Thank you. That's S.J. Sindhu reading Gods in the Surf from our new collection, Dominant Genes. We're going to wrap up here and have you tell us what you're working on next before we let you go.
Awesome. I have two graphic novels coming out. One next year called Shakti, and another one called Tall Water in 2024.
We're excited. We're excited.
Yeah, I'm working on my third literary novel called War Child, about Tamil immigrants living in Toronto.
Well, we hope to see them here and have you back. That sounds very exciting. Pleasure to have you this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. S.J. Sindhu, author of Dominant Genes, thank you for being with us. And now this.
Born from humble beginnings, Ron Peterson emerged with a PhD in physics to play a role in many important scientific discoveries and became a key executive in Honeywell, one of America's largest corporations. Along the way, he worked with Nobel Prize winners, testy bosses, altruists, and people hanging on the edge of society, learning from each of them. An Introvert Learns to Fly is an often humorous memoir chock full of life lessons from us all. Ron, thanks for joining me on Right on Radio.
Thanks a lot, Josh. I appreciate the opportunity.
While reading An Introvert Learns to Fly, you mentioned that your father recommended you go to barber school if the whole science thing doesn't work out. Did he ever change his mind about what he said to you?
I think so. He died in about 1982, and I'd been a scientist, and actually I'd gotten promoted a couple of times by then. So I think he had given up on the idea. Also, it would have been a horrible idea because that was just about when people stopped cutting their hair back when I started going to school. There was a lot of, that was sort of the hippie era, and I probably would have starved to death if I'd have followed his advice.
Did you ever contemplate a hippie lifestyle at all?
I must not, maybe I was just too busy. It was kind of I mean, I tended to agree with the politics of it all, but it was, you know, and I didn't really like the idea of the war very much, but it was, I wasn't going to, you know, wear flowers in my hair and go off. And it was, I think in the book, you probably read the part where I was in the basement laboratories doing my experiments while there were riots outside at the University of Illinois. And they had curfews, so I ended up sleeping on an air mattress underneath my desk probably for weeks on end, so I didn't have to violate any of the, you know, because I would have had to walk about eight blocks home, and there's a lot of police out there, and it was, could have been dangerous. So mostly I was just trying to get things done. It's kind of been true my whole life, just, you know, do as much useful stuff as you can in the time you've got.
You also talk about in the book too, how a superpower of yours that's maybe sometimes been both an advantage and disadvantage is that you can become extremely focused on a subject matter where you can kind of lose track of reality around you. Is that partially what we think was a symptom of that?
For sure. I mean, I was so dedicated to getting a PhD ever since some kids in high school said that no one from our high school ever got a PhD. And it was sort of like it became a must. I think it's also why I'm able to write books, because most normal people would say, I'm not going to spend a year and a half writing something, which may or may not be even useful. And but when I get on a project, I kind of like to, it's a big advantage to be able to focus like that, to learn things. And but it also means people around me are wondering what I'm up to, you know.
You told me recently you had an interest in biochemistry and genetics while reading The Codebreaker by Walter Isaacson. What led you to your interest in becoming a scientist?
Well, I mean, that's an evolutionary process. I think when I was in grade school, I learned that I was really pretty good in math. Father put me on display whenever anybody came over. And I did some things which surprised teachers. And I think when I hit the eighth grade, when I finally was in a school where all the rich schools kind of came together at middle school, I got the highest score on a math test. And it was like, what? Maybe I am good at this. So that was part of it. And I started building a telescope. And I got some teachers who really encouraged me, way beyond, you know, what teachers are supposed to do. I think in ninth grade, we had to say what we wanted to be. And I put down teacher, engineer, or scientist. And then I studied to see which ones made the most money and things like that. And so by the time I was in high school, I either wanted to be a world-class high jumper or a scientist. So somewhere along the line, that decision was kind of made, you know, whether that was plausible. You know, with my father saying, this can't work. He had never heard of somebody in the family being a scientist. So it was, you know, it's been kind of a challenge and an adventure the whole time, going to college and graduate school. I didn't really have any tutors or people who were examples for me to follow. It was like everything was an adventure. Everything was a discovery, which I kind of like, but it also meant it was...
I think gives permission to and take risks where otherwise you had examples before you to base off your decision-making you would not do otherwise. So I definitely get that.
Yeah.
Outside of science, what other professions did you ever think about pursuing?
Being a teacher was certainly a natural. I loved doing that when I was in graduate school. I suppose becoming a professor and being research and teaching would have been ideal, but I really like teaching people. Yeah, that's why I'm teaching my grandchildren now.
What about teaching? Do you like? Is it just connecting with people about subject matter that you share a common interest in?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like when I discover something, I want to tell other people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because I want them to know that I know it or what, but I think I had tons of fun in graduate school. I literally tried to make sure all the class passed the tests, and I used to throw liquid air on the class if they seemed to be dozing off, just to wake them up. And you can be very creative as a teacher. That would have worked out fine too.
I like this anecdote you share in the book about there was a young woman who, I believe your focus was for kids, people who are going to become nurses or doctors. And she said she'd never gotten less than an A in her life. And she was struggling in your class. And then you were nice enough to talk with her, come outside class, and more like just give her emotional support, I think, and to come back in and have confidence in her abilities.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a gal who got a C. And she had never, and so she ran out of the class crying. And for a while, I didn't know what to do. It's like, should I just let her go or whatever? And eventually I just told the class to hang in there, and I went out and sat on a bench and talked to her for a while. For me, those classes were sort of a one-on-one thing because I was tutoring almost everybody. And you're right, they were all pre-med or pre-nursing. And that class was set up to screen out the people who didn't deserve that. Mm-hmm. And so they all knew that that was a class you had to pass. And I tried to teach it in a way so that they could all pass the tests, you know, and make it as fun as possible.
Who are some of your heroes in science?
Well, I've always tried to have a heroes list, and some people drop in and out. I noticed you suggested Heisenberg. I was trying to, I had seen a movie where the idea was that he actually slowed down the Nazi program to develop an atomic bomb. And he came across as sort of a hero. And I would have added him to my list. But there's also a lot of people who say that wasn't quite true, and that and he didn't deserve the credit, that he just goofed up and slowed it down by making errors. But yeah, I mean, I can't remember who I put on my list. John Bardeen, who was a double Nobel Prize winner. He was on my advisory committee for graduate school, held in a lot of esteem. He had helped invent the transistor, and then he developed the theory for superfluidity about a year after I got to, got the Nobel Prize about a year after I got to Illinois. And I actually spent a couple hours with him talking about projects and research that he co-authored with us in the early, the whole thing. He was such a quiet and out, I mean, he was the kind of person anybody could come and talk to for an hour, even a, you know, first year graduate student. The other extreme is, of course, Richard Feynman, who was, you know, like the definition of charisma. And I think I mentioned to you, when he would walk into a room, he couldn't just walk into a room. As soon as he opened the door, you knew he was coming, because he's waving his arms and he's shouting at some imaginary friend. And that's the way he taught, you know, the classes, that they were just totally engaging. And I guess that shows that you can have different personalities and be a scientist, which is good to know.
You got into Caltech and you had the opportunity to take a graduate course with Feynman on quantum electrodynamics. And in the book, you said you had a confrontation with him. And I was wondering if you could talk about that. It was an issue of your grade, I believe. You asked to switch it to a pass-fail. Is that correct?
Not quite. It was the actual way it happened was that there was this long line of students on the final day that you could drop the class. And I was at the end of this line, and all these people were chemistry students and different majors. And he kept, as they came up to him, he kept saying, "No, I'm not going to sign your drop slip. Be brave, young man," is what he kept repeating. And finally, I got there, and as a physics major, I thought, yikes, I'm in real trouble. And basically, I just said, "Hey, I'm taking three other physics courses. I'm working for this professor on the side, and I just can't do your course justice." And he said, "Oh, okay." And so he signed the drop card for me, which was unfortunate, because he did make it a pass-fail class the next Monday. Then I ended up going to all the classes anyway, so I could have gotten a pass. He was kind of a frightening person to walk right up and talk to. I mean, I guess he wouldn't have said that, but he's like regarded as one of the, you know, the 10 best scientists of the 20th century, I think.
I was shocked. You got into a fight with someone in grad school?
Well, there are times when I can be stubborn. There was a chair, a big easy chair facing a TV in our living room in the grad school, where three of us lived in the same house. And this one really big, I like to call him a rude Chicago guy. And I've had a couple confrontations with rude Chicago guys. One was at an airport where this guy with a Cadillac kept trying to cut me off as we're going to an exit at an airport thing. And I'm driving my 13-year-old Cougar with plastic-sized walls, because it rusted out so much. And I just thought, you have far more to lose on this than I do. So I just kept edging ahead, and eventually the guy gave up. But the guy in our house where we were staying in grad school came back from something, and he saw me sitting in what he considered his chair right in front of the TV. And he tried to drag me out of there, and I was resisting, and we got into a pushing match and broke a lamp and some other things, but it didn't get into, you know, actually punching or anything.
Okay. You refer to yourself as an odd vice president of one of the largest corporations in the U.S. Besides being a self-made introvert, what made you peculiar as a vice president at Honeywell, And I was talk about that, but I also want to know, in comparison to yourself, what were the other personalities like among the executives?
Well, as you can imagine, most vice presidents tend to be very outgoing. There's a reason they got to their positions. When a couple of occasions come to mind, when we would have parties with all the general managers, there at the beginning, there were only three of us who had spouses who were still working. And for Miriam and I, that was seemed like a normal thing to do. But out of the 80 VPs or something that were there, there was only three of us, and including five women whose husbands had stopped working. You know, so it was kind of like, this is our job, is to do this. And eventually those two other people who were also from different research centers, also their spouses quit. So Miriam and I became the only ones. So that makes us a bit odd, the fact that I respected Miriam enough to know that her job as a teacher, she's a high school Spanish teacher, was as important for our family as my job. The other time was once we were at a meeting and they went around the room with a bunch of general managers and asked, what would you do if we suddenly gave you $100,000? And in that room, every single person named something that they would buy. And when they got to me, I said, I'd just put it in the bank. And everybody kind of gave me a strange look, like, what? That's not why we're here. We're here to make so much money that we can spend it. And I mean, also when we'd go on trips to India or places like that, everybody else or Japan, they had to come back with a whole string of pearls, you know, that was 2,000 or 3,000. They had to be willing. It was almost like a competition to see who could spend the most. And that was not, it just wasn't a priority for me. So that's kind of, that's the way I'm thinking. I'm a little bit odd. I mean, all the way through my career, I thought that the only way I would get ahead was if I did things which were remarkable. I had to get more business. I had to solve more problems. I had to do better research. And I didn't actually compete to get ahead. It was more like I had to prove that before there was an opening.
I want your video clip from the Context Conference. And at the very end, I don't remember what the gentleman's name is. I don't think they said in the video, but you told him, I guess he shared a story of how you told him one point, you wake up every morning and wonder how I'm going to impact the world. And I came across a quote actually from Thomas Jefferson saying that he saw himself as someone who's more interested in the dreams of the future than the history of the past. And it reminded me of you. I was curious if you saw yourself in that way.
Yeah, that's probably the case. I mean, it was a bit of an overstatement when he said that I woke up every morning thinking my only job was to change the world. Because, I mean, but to be honest, that was a consideration when I decided to become a scientist. Because especially in high school, I'm still kind of introverted. And it was like, okay, how can I have a real impact on the world? It's not going to be by becoming a politician and so the only thing that made sense to me was I knew that scientists, if they're successful, can invent something or come up with an idea, which once the idea happens, the world is changed. You know, it's, it's a way to change the world without, you know, having to brag about it. You just do it. You make something happen. And so, yeah, that is kind of my focus. Clearly, my writing about the future all the time. And I keep, if you go to my website, the only thing on there is, I think that every single email I send out about my business, it says, okay, here's news from the future. It's just the way I think. I mean, that's my thing. It's, I mean, and the other problem is that I don't have a great memory. I never could have been a doctor or a lawyer because just too much memorization. It's just, those are things which are backward looking, I think. and they require too much remembering too many things.
Okay. Now this sparks a question for me. So I'm curious, how do you describe your thought process? If you examine your own thought process as it's happening, is it holistic? Do you feel like you're using all your brain to arrive at one point that is a synthesis of everything you realize the answer, I guess, in a way? Is that how you would visualize or kind of explain to someone how you think?
It's interesting you should say that, because it's like if you were to talk about how I wrote the book, the novel, so where do ideas come from? You're right. It's kind of holistic. But when I was writing the book, I would go out for long walks and with a general question of something about the next chapter. And then ideas would pop in. It happens a lot in the morning when I wake up or while I'm taking a shower or something, I'll get an idea. I think it's all of my subconscious is coming up with, especially when it came to writing a book about a science fiction novel. You have to have a way of pulling things out. You can also learn from reading other people's stuff and then extrapolating that. And that's what I did. I would just jump on an idea and figure out how to make it exciting. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I don't really know where my ideas come from all the time.
No, I think you gave a great response. I think for a lot of people that's the case. So it's a point where you're not really having fixed or focused attention on anything, so you can just let your mind wander. So you're called a futurist of Honeywell, but I know you're also called Dr. Quack. I was wondering if you could talk about where that title came from.
Oh, that's a good one. Incidentally, my Twitter handle is Quacky2000, by the way.
I saw that, yeah.
So it's something that stuck with me. I think I used to visit San Francisco a lot with my supervisor, Henry Marr, and we would always go to Chinatown. We'd eat out at the restaurants. And after a couple of these occasions, we would be going there quite often, or to Monterey or whatever. And he convinced me I had to bring back a frozen duck. And I really liked duck because I had tried it. And so I always would have a frozen duck in my briefcase or carrying that back. And one time I got back into the Honeywell building, there was this long, long hallway, maybe two blocks long in one of the buildings. And I'm walking in there and I came across a few people from our group that knew me, and I pull out the duck and said, "Do you want to see my duck?" Which was kind of random, but and after that, I was known as Dr. Quack, and it sort of was fun because I started putting little ducks and things in my office, and when I got promoted to director or manager, there was a giant cake, one for 200 people because it was a big party. And there was a picture of Donald Duck on there saying, "Congratulations, Dr. Quack." So it kind of stuck after that.
I think my last question for you is kind of a tough one. You mentioned the difficulty of accepting your son-in-law's decision to become Catholic due to his, I'm going to quote you here, its long history and clarity about its positions. How did you, Ron, reconcile your faith with your background as a scientist?
Yeah, in the book, I kind of waited till the end of the book because it seems like a question that as a scientist that I had to at least address in the book. When I was at Caltech, that was kind of atheist central for universities. It was like that was the accepted point of view, was that they're, believing in any sort of God was a mistake. Let me do a slight aside here. I think that one thing that's interesting is I think that the human ability to see things which aren't there is one of our greatest strengths and weaknesses. It's kind of like my ability to work too long on things. But when I work with my grandchildren, I point out that, okay, you can't actually see an atom. You can't see an electron. But those things are there. And I go through and try to show them how it was proved that they were really there through experiments. But the point is that being able to see things in beyond through telescopes that aren't visible to the human eye is one of the greatest strengths that humans have. On the other hand, it causes people to believe in all sorts of crazy things, like not getting vaccinated now and other things, which, because everybody has the ability to dream and to see things beyond where they are, and we kind of say that's okay to be able to do that. So I tend to think that the scientific method is needed, so there's a reason why you can believe in something which you can't see, but it's sort of the central conundrum on religion or non-religion. And I tried to address it in the book by just saying that I didn't really have a good answer, that I understood the arguments of my roommates and friends. I had tons of Jewish friends at Caltech. And there's a lot of different points of view. And I think I eventually said in the book, hey, I could argue that there is a God, and I've done that at our church, and given the 7 different reasons why I think that's likely. But I could also argue with the other 7 reasons why that's probably not correct, and I could argue with myself on these things. So I came down in the book by just saying, hey, I'm agnostic.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Savvy.
And I'm Josh. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, S.J. Sindhu and Ronald E. Peterson, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.